Welcome to 2024 and Season 5 of the Religion Podcast, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion.
Hi, Joel.
Hey, how are you, Dad?
I'm great. We just had a 10-minute conversation with some tech issues. We don't need to have it again. Our audience appreciates it. How are you?
I'm
good,
fine.
Good. Let's go.
This is take three. You don't get to see, take one and then the cuss words and then take two and then the seven times cuss words. So you're only seeing take three.
But it does bring up, by the way, meta point, each take, one of us has said something which has led the other one of us to say something that's like an interesting topic. So something just came to me, Joel, is, the idea of, and it's so true in both of our organizations where people are volunteers, and not just volunteers, but us too, when people are like, oh, they worked so hard on this. I think about that. Like, we just worked so hard to record a podcast, but it didn't work. So do we get credit for that? I sometimes think about it, like, if I take 10 hours to write a mediocre sermon, is that better than 2 hours to write a really good sermon? Like, it's just interesting in terms of, like, people talk about how hard people work or how long people work, but not always how effective people are. So, like, you and I just worked really hard and we're completely ineffective, right?
Right. And technology seems to be a way that we're supposed to be more effective, but the little problems that arise and the troubleshooting of them and the upgrades and the drivers and the downloads and that is the stuff that makes me less efficient, even with the tool that is supposed to guarantee me being more efficient. I hate that conundrum.
Yeah, 100%. But do you know what I mean, though, about our organizations that, it's like they worked so hard on this? Well, and I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek right now, obviously, because I feel the same way, too. If I work really hard on something and something doesn't go to plan, like I want, quote unquote, credit, too, whether it's as a volunteer or as a professional. But at the end of the day, it's the results that matter. It's not the work that got to the results. Not to say that the work doesn't matter. I don't know. It's a rabbit hole. I think about this a lot. I actually do think about this a lot. But I'm a strange person. I don't know.
Well, if our topic today is going to be something around sacrifice, you're setting us up for that. What does it mean to work hard, give of self, to sacrifice time or money or treasure or effort or energy? And then what does that mean for God's bigger purposes or for the people that we love and serve? The thing that I hate is when people say, oh, I know you're really busy, and they say that as an excuse for why they're interrupting, or they say that as an excuse for why they're not telling me the truth and they're just escaping from a deep pastoral conversation. For me, I never want somebody else to judge me from the outside as too busy for them. I want them to allow me to make the decision about what I do next. And if sitting still with you and having a coffee and talking for a really long time about what's going on in your life is where I want to spend this, don't judge whether you think I am too busy to do that with and for you. Just let me be the judge of that. At the same time, if I am really busy and you need me right now, and I say, I'm sorry, I can't stop doing what I'm doing. I really need to finish. I'll get to you as soon as I'm done. Then trust me on that as well. And know that I'm not being personally dismissive or shunning of your need, or I'm not demoting you below some other requirement of my pastoral ministry. I'm just asking you to honor me and let me finish something that is also really important.
Slow clap. And first of all, you're giving me way too much credit to think that my small diatribe led into the topic. I did not mean for that to be the case. But yeah, I mean, this is something I think about all the time too. And for me, I don't think about it as busyness. I think about it as priority. Everything is important, but not everything is important now, right? So, you know, I think this is attributed to Eisenhower, that Eisenhower had this matrix where it's like there was important but not crucial. And crucial meaning you have to do it right now. Mm-hmm. Important but not crucial, but also crucial but not important. So, for example, like if the groceries get delivered, and that's crucial. If I don't go outside to, this just happened earlier this morning. If I don't go outside to bring the groceries in, they go bad. But that's not like life-threateningly. It's not as important as like my friendship with you or my congregation or, you know, my children. Mm-hmm. But things at different times take different priority. And we might be going down almost like a productivity rabbit hole now, but on last Friday, this is not said passive aggressively. This is absolutely on me. I was being emailed and texted nonstop on Friday from congregants about something that matters. I mean, it's something that's important. But it was also something that could have been done over email. It could have been done a little more thoughtfully without like, that kind of rushed mentality. And my ability to kind of do deep work on Friday, like my sermon writing or thinking about adult ed 2 weeks from then, suffered because I kind of allowed myself that nonstop bombardment. And I could have and should have said, you know what, guys? This is important and it will get done, but it will not get done by me today. And that would have been okay. And to be fair, I have no hesitation that my congregants wouldn't have had a problem with that either. Mm-hmm. That's why I say this was completely on me. But you know, sometimes we need that discipline too. It's not just on the congregants giving us the trust. It's like ourselves giving it to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are writing. It'll probably be 20 to 25-ish pages, slides, of full color, graphics, pictures, text, an annual report. And it is a review of what we promised to do last year with and for each other in our community and what we pledged to do this year with and for our community, including our how we allocate resources of staff and budget and space. And this document's a big deal to me. I care about it a lot, and it's hard to assemble because there's a board and 9 committees and then another board with 3 subcommittees and plus a few other little pieces that have to get built in, and there's a bazillion opinions. And so I've been working on it since the retreat Saturday, and on Monday afternoon, I checked and I had 100 emails, over 100 emails, little red dots, you know, that I had not responded to well. And that was because I was deep in focus every hour I got. I am trying to build the base template of this thing and make it look good and right and ready. And I realized I can't stall it anymore. I have to pause and dive deep into these emails and see which ones are priority and which ones are urgent and hit those. And the ones that then are priority but not urgent decide what my response will be. The ones that are urgent but not priority decide what my response will be. And everything else just gets deleted or filed. But then I realized once I do that, my brain space is not ready to dive back into the missional crafting of this annual report. And I had to go, you know, downstairs and get a snack and walk the dog, you know, and just to like clean off the logistical busyness, just to come back and go back into the important things. And I don't know if that's, I don't think of that as sacrifice, if that's going to be our topic today. But I think of that as something that is, we ask each other to sacrifice for our presumed priorities and urgencies all the time. And each of us make a weird decision as we say, yes or later or no or never. And I'm not sure that I do that very well, but I sense the struggle of doing it, especially from a pastoral role, to people whose expectations of me are typically very urgent and not always high priority. And you can't say that to a person for them. What
Correct.
If it's urgent, it's a high priority for them. And I don't know how to gently say, I sense the urgency for you. Can we set a time where I can give it due priority?
Yeah. And I think both of us agree that, you know, a pastoral emergency is not one of those things, right? You know, like you hear of someone, God forbid, getting into an accident or getting really bad health news. Like, yeah, you drop the sermon, you drop the groceries. Like, I think we're talking about, you know, just, you know, the different buffetings that might come at us.
So where did the question of sacrifice come from?
Yes, speaking of,
what does it look and sound like?
Yeah. So I think it was the same congregant that I have that gave us our topic 2 weeks ago. I think it may have come up, either it came up in adult ed. We're doing this fun thing in adult ed. There's this very large book written in the early 20th century called Legends of the Jews. It was compiled by a man named Louis Ginsberg. And it's huge. I mean, it's huge. And Legends of the Jews is basically his attempt to take legends, midrashim, stories, things that aren't in the Torah, but in other bodies of Jewish text or kind of extant in Jewish culture and, you know, wisdom literature, and putting them in almost chronological order, starting with God, actually starting before God created the world, going through creation, Adam, Eve, Cain, etc. And there are these interesting, sometimes very bizarre legends, and they were going through it systematically. So it's not like, okay, read 100 pages and we're going to talk about it. It's like, read 6 pages and we're going to talk for 45 minutes about maybe, you know, one or two of the small stories, because they really lend themselves to question and interpretation. So that's what we're doing in adult ed. And I don't know if the concept of sacrifice came through one of those conversations, but, you know, sacrifice is one of these words where everybody, quote unquote, knows what it means. And so by virtue, no one knows what it means. And also, you know, depending on context, like a lot of powerfully laden symbolic words, it can mean something else. So, you know, the sacrifice that was done in the temple is very different than, okay, Joel, I'll make that sacrifice for you. You know, and religiously, from a Jewish standpoint, what it meant, what it means, I think is a foundational part of who we are. You know, I certainly know about the sacraments. I don't know if those are considered sacrifices. You know, if you wanted to speak to that, he's shaking his head no, ladies and gentlemen. but you know, Christianity never really did sacrifices the way Judaism did. So, you know, curious how that's a concept for you. And yeah, tell me how you want to start.
So first, so this book, it's not scriptural stories and myths and traditions. It is deuterocanonical. So it's the as you said, the plural midrashim, the stories that others imagined as they tried to unpack the meanings of scripture and story.
That's exactly correct and very well said. I'll also share, and I'll send this to you, Joel. There's this wonderful website. It's called Sepharia. That its mission is basically to put most, if not all, of foundational Jewish text into a free, searchable, linkable easy to use source, and Legends of the Jews in English is available. And so if anyone wants to see what this is, it's very readable. Like I said, at times it's very weird, almost like there's like magic and, you know, Adam was 900 feet tall to begin with. I mean, there's some weird stuff, but there's also some really, really cool stuff too. So, you know, I'll send that to you for the show notes.
Okay. Well, that word sacrifice, it kind of means there's a holy in it, saker. You can hear it in there. And it is in the word, the Christian word sacrament, or sacramental. But that doesn't necessarily imply the term sacrifice is different than the term sacrament. They are both connected through the holy, the saker part of that word. But the connection beyond that is limited. And for me, I guess the ancient meaning of sacrifice is, hey, our community believes and agrees that if we come together and give up something or take on something hard, heavy, if we do or let go or give back something, then there will be a reward or a reduction in punishment from whoever the spirits / gods are over and around us. And that becomes a belief system, right? So we as a community offer these things so that the gods won't do this or so that the gods will do this. And a sacrifice can be a positive. We are going to give this, or it can be a negative. We're going to stop doing this. You could say, you know, I'm going to stop smoking as a sacrificial act in a way.
Like in Lent, right? Like I'm going to sacrifice chocolate or something like that.
Nice. So there's
not
something...
that I do that. First of all, I don't celebrate Lent, but also I would never give up chocolate. Both of hey, those things.
Ash Wednesday is just a couple, 3 weeks away, buddy.
Yes.
So does that resonate with you in your either scriptural or deuterocanonical space?
Okay. Well, so you talked about, I guess, the Latin connection, right? So the Hebrew connection, the verb to sacrifice comes from the same, well, not comes from, it literally means to draw closer, lehit karev. And, you know, an idea, of course, is we're drawing closer God, which speaks to what you said, like we sacrifice to quote unquote get something. We want to get closer to God. Now, in the Torah, God commands not just a sacrifice, but all sorts of sacrifices. There's the sin offering. So you do something wrong, you have to bring such and such cows with no blemishes, and you have to do this and that. There's the Thanksgiving offering, when you're grateful for something. There's a cleanliness purification. So sacrifice. So there's, and they're all different, okay? Now, when the temple was destroyed in the year 70, the way Judaism kind of worked with regard to law was sacrifice couldn't be done anymore because the sacrifices could only be done in the temple. Now there's no temple, which means no sacrifice. And this is why this year of 70 is such a paradigm shift for Judaism, because Judaism essentially became portable. This is where the synagogue took over the temple. And it's why, as a slight aside, but not worth editing out, I think it's an important aside, unlike every other digression this morning, that's why for some Jews, they will never call a synagogue a temple, because that distinction is important.
Yeah.
The temple was the place in Jerusalem that existed before the year 70. Okay.
Nice.
So prayer now takes the place of sacrifice. So our words, which also bring us closer, and I use that in the broadest sense, it brings us closer to God, it brings us closer to ourselves, our ideals, right? But I like that idea of, you know, bringing us closer to holiness. The English connotation of I'm going to sacrifice, like I'm going to give up something that I really want, isn't really in the Hebrew, the mitzvah of offering a sacrifice. I don't know the morphing of how that word in English came to mean kind of, you know, what it means to us just colloquially. Mm-hmm.
And if I'm guessing, like, so what's the root of the Hebrew word that you're talking about?
So kuf, like, kuf, re, I'm going to look it up to make sure I'm correct. Kush, resh, vet.
Okay. And the V, he said vet, right? So that V sound can often be a B when we transliterate it into English. So it's probably karab or something like that if we just simply say it quickly. Who knows? I'm a 40% pro here, not a 90% pro. But if I'm right about this, whether it's in Greek or Hebrew, there are probably a lot of ancient words that English just quickly throws sacrifice over. So if this karav means to draw near, there may be other Hebrew words that also quickly get translated as sacrifice that have something to do with slaughter or that have something to do with offer. And we may kind of whitewash the nuances of Hebrew language sacrifice with one big English term, sacrifice. And my guess is we may do that in the Greek as well. I love that you started with the draw near, because there is something about sacred sacrifice that requires our proximity to God, whether it's a real proximity or an assumed / believed proximity. It means that we are going to move ourselves into a vulnerable space, and we are going to expose ourselves to the holy, and we are going to hope and trust that our presence and our actions and our words here have an impact on the holy, and the holy then has some impact on us in return. And there's a beautiful aspect of that sacrifice concept. There's also some dangerous parts, like the quid pro quo-ness of it, as if we bring the right sacrifice at the right time, we pin God down and make God do what we expect, or where our religious leaders can trick us into making, quote, sacred sacrifices that have nothing to do with God, but that have everything to do with maintenance of the power of the religious leadership or the institution of the religion itself.
Absolutely.
And that happened a lot in ancient times. It happened a lot in Christian churches. Part of the Reformation was a rejection of the assumption that you could buy your dead relatives out of purgatory with a certain amount of money. And the sacrifice you made by offering those penances, or I forget what the term is called, but when you gave a certain amount of money to the priest, it forced God to release your relative from purgatory into the greater kingdom of heaven and give me a break, right? Sovereignty of God suggests God is not purchasable. God's actions are free from us.
But this is what's so interesting about the idea of a covenantal relationship. I mean, it is that the Torah is written explicitly sometimes as if it was transactional. So in some ways, I don't think you can blame people for that instinct. Now, there's the idea that I like, which is, you know, similarly to how you ethically, I'm saying this like as I'm laughing because I don't know that I'm doing a very good job of it. You know, you train a child to learn right from wrong by first, you know, they know what they're allowed to do and they know what's permitted and they know what's forbidden. And from that, they get a sense of then right or wrong for kind of a moral reason. And in Judaism, we as a people first kind of learning this relationship with God, we need a God that kind of makes sense. Like, we are children in that regard. And so the early in the Torah, it has that kind of very formulaic language. But then later on, when God doesn't talk to as many people in as much detail, then it's a little more vague. But yeah, I agree. In terms of my personal theology, you know, this isn't like, okay, how many check marks does God need for me in order to then do something good for me? Like, that's not how God works.
Nice. And maybe that's where, Calvin and some of the other reformers in Christian theological history talked about the multiple uses of the law. Why does the law exist? Why do the commandments exist? Why is it so clean and crisp and clear? You shall not. And they said, okay, for somebody who's new at this or maybe immature or a rookie at trying to put themselves in the vulnerable space of near to the holy, there is to teach you right from wrong. That's the first use of the law. It's just clarity about what the expectations are and the possible consequences. The second use of the law, which is more nuanced, is to humble us, to, in heavily Christian language, convict us of our sin, meaning to squish us all the way down so we realize none of us can meet the requirements of the law. We are all insufficiently able to fulfill the expectation. And that, if we theologically agree to that, it changes the covenant, right? If a covenant is a contract with God, and some people think simplistically that the covenant of God is contractual, meaning I, God, will blank if when y'all blank. And then we naively think, okay, we're on it, and we try to fulfill all the rules and regulations and boundaries. And then we later learn we can't. Hey, God, this law is kind of unfair. We can't meet it, right? How are you still going to hold up your end of the bargain, even though we can't hold up ours? And that's where you realize, okay, this was never a contract. This was a covenant. God's loyalty and mercy and grace and chesed, steadfast love towards us, is way stronger than our ability to meet the contractual obligations, or the sacrifices of the law. And then the third use of the law, after you go through the humility part, is to show us how to live. We don't do it to earn something back from God. There's no quid pro quo in it anymore. So we don't sacrifice our obedience to the law to force God to do something. We obey it out of gratitude for God's ridiculous mercy and grace to us, even when we suck at following the law. And it doesn't demean the sacrifice. It just takes away the quid pro quo-ness of it. It takes away the contractual nature of it, the if-then nature of it, and lets God stay God, a beautifully merciful, gracious, ever-present, loving parent, and is honest about our ability to truly sacrifice in such a way that meets God's expectations.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I like that a lot.
You know, it's pretty Christian-y. Does it resonate with you?
Oh, it's totally Christian-y. Well, what resonates is kind of the I don't want to say unknowability, but the non-deterministic. Let's put it that way: that God is not deterministic. And you know, in terms of sacrifices, one of the things that I find meaningful about the sacrificial system as outlined mostly in Leviticus is the fact that there are different sacrifices. In other words, just as you approach one congregant differently than another based on who they are and your relationship and your history and how you're feeling that day. We approach God differently dependent on our past behavior and what we're looking to accomplish and all those things. And prayer, you know, I mentioned that in Judaism, prayer is meant to kind of, quote unquote, take the place of the traditional sacrifice. And of course, there are many prayers that do different things. We have prayers that we call petitionary prayers. God, I want you to provide good agriculture. God, I want you to provide me with health. And then we also have prayers of kind of an expiation of sin, for lack of a better word. God, forgive me for not, you know, doing X or for doing Y, which I shouldn't have done. And so the variation of those is a very kind of relationshipy kind of thing. Like that resonates, I think, so truly and deeply with how human beings operate and just live in the world, that we don't approach God the same way on Tuesday morning as we do Wednesday night, for example, you know. And I don't know, that's something that I've always found particularly meaningful about Judaism, is that there's not like a catch-all. Mm-hmm. I mean, there can be sometimes. I mean, you could say the Shehecheyanu prayer, thank you, God, for allowing me to reach this time. But if you lengthen that out, you know, each time of day kind of has its own specificity to it. And so, you know, and the sacrificial system really, I think, started that.
I think the sacrificial system is a natural evolution of trying to get very simplistic people who are operating in the if-then quid pro quo faith structure to move towards the nuanced humility. But there is a fork in the road there. Priests, those of us who are responsible for leading the people through the sacrifices, if we do it too literally, we restrict the ability for people to understand the nuances of God. And the right? But if we do it too lazily, then the holiness, the awe, the wonder of the God behind the sacrifice is lost. So we priests, rabbis, pastors, we have a responsibility to invite people into moments of holy offering of self, so that there is awe and wonder, but it never has a contractual bind on God.
That's well said. Yes. Yes.
A mom has a child in a hospital who's really sick, and she believes in the power of prayer. So she prays her fanny off, and he's still sick. And so she asks her congregation to pray with her, and he's still sick. And so she starts emailing every congregation that she's ever heard of and asking them to pray, and he's still sick. And then she starts Googling every congregation she can find and asking them to pray, and he's still sick, right? She's operating under a systematic theology, whether she knows it or not, that her sacrifice and our communal sacrifice of prayer will bind God into healing her child. And if healing doesn't come, she has a system that did not work for her. Mm. She will look back on that and say, hey, priest, pastor, who taught me prayer works, it didn't work. Why did I sacrifice? And why did I ask my friends to sacrifice themselves and time and prayer and energy and attention for something that doesn't change God? And so I feel like we've got to be really careful if we talk about sacrifices. In some ways, are just disciplines. They're just practices. They are things that we intentionally take on or let go to change the world. But don't think of them as forcing God into obeying our will. Think of them as bending us to God's will.
This is that. That's kind of the last point I have too. I was thinking as you were saying something else about sacrifice from the Torah is oftentimes it's meant to serve as kind of a catalyst for a realization. So let me give an example that anyone familiar with the Bible will know. When Abraham is about to sacrifice his son Isaac that God commands him to do, Abraham's about to do it, and God or an angel yells his name, Abraham, Abraham. And then he looks up, and what does he see? He sees a ram kind of stuck, you know, in the thicket. And Abraham sacrifices that ram, and that starts kind of a new chapter of life for Abraham. And so sometimes the sacrifice is almost like epiphany might be too strong of a concept, but like a self-realization that we have, or something that diverts our thinking from one way to another way that is hopefully more helpful, more healthy, more holy, etc.
Yay. Yeah, there's a deconstruction of the old system that happens. And even in Abraham's mind, he thought, if I blank, God will blank. So, and he gets up there and he does something different. He doesn't obey the original if. So that him laying down and letting that old system be deconstructed. And at the same time, everything gets bigger and more complex, which is where the wonder and awe are possible. It almost seems irresponsible to talk about sacrifice without throwing Jesus in here a little.
Him. I mean, great. Not literally.
So, yeah, I gotcha. So far, I've been like just trying to stay big picture and not bringing in, for Christians, like we try to imagine whoever God is and whatever God wants being embodied somehow in the fleshy human and teachings of this Palestinian Jew from Nazareth. And now some Christians will say Jesus is the last sacrifice. And we have a letter in our New Testament that also calls him both the priest and the lamb at the last sacrifice. Meaning to say, right, he somehow was presiding over the sacrifice and the sacrificed, you know, the object that was sacrificed at the same time. And some people then, Christians, will quickly, this is where it bothers me, right? The whole concept of a sacrifice is to move you from the simplistic through the humble toward the bigger nuanced. And then Jesus' sacrifice doesn't bring humility or nuance at all. It just gets resimplified. God saw sin. God needed a sacrifice. Therefore, God killed Jesus, and now sin's forgiven. And I'm like, wait. Come on, y'all. Can we get more nuance, please? In the end, what happened is we simplistically thought that if we killed him, then that would free us from God's expectations. And so we killed Jesus. Like, bad Christians say Jews killed Jesus, right? That was Hitler.
Yeah. And his it's a misunderstanding of history. I mean, it's just, yes.
Yeah. So it was, religious leaders and religious people and political leaders, right? It was humanity that looked upon, let's say, well, you don't have to agree here, right? But let's just say God was trying to show us something, tell us something unique and special in this dude, Jesus of Nazareth. The last thing we wanted was for that to be the way it is. So we tried to erase him, and we did it as a sacrifice on a crucifix. But God does not let it in there. Like, our misuse of sacrificing him for all the wrong reasons, this steadfast love of God still lets life and hope and peace come through our poorly executed sacrifice. And there's supposed to be a hope there, But it's really sticky for some people.
Yeah. Nope. That's very true. Very true.
What are you sacrificing lately?
Sleep. What am I sacrificing lately? In what context?
What are you doing to make God happy?
I mean, I'm trying to keep a nuanced and fair and human perspective with everything going on in the Middle East.
Yeah.
What about you?
For me, I've got this massive project, and I've been interrupted several times by fairly important moments with humans, and I've tried to stop and be with that human and listen. And in a way, it feels sacrificial because I have a very important task that needs to get done, and I'm not doing it. And in a way, it feels super holy, right? There's a holiness to that conversation, that listening moment, that pastoral moment. And it doesn't feel very sacrificial in the end. So it's a drawing nearness more than an offering, and I like it.
Gotcha. Sounds good. Well, until next week.
Keep it real. Thank you for joining us on the Real Religion podcast today, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion. I'm Reverend Joel Talbert, and on behalf of Rabbi Eric Linder and all the Real Religion fans out there, we thank you for being with us today and invite you to send us any feedback or suggestions or topic ideas to realreligionpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep it real.